Now, they're really the heirs of that top layer of serfs on the 13th century manors that we looked at earlier. Now, in the 15th century, these people aren't just comparatively prosperous in economic terms. They're also legally free. Now they do have access to the king's courts, and they can vote to elect the Knights of the Shire in parliamentary elections. And they often have enough financial resources to educate their sons for a career in the church. And this had been seen for a very long time as the prime means of social mobility. But now you have a second avenue of mobility opening up. The law is now another option. The courts provide good opportunities for advancement. You can train on the job, basically, at the Inns of Court in London, rather than going to the universities. And so this is a major route by which men from the countryside find their fortune in the city. But some yeoman farmers are even successful enough, they even accumulate enough land that they can climb up into the lower ranks of the gentry. Now, I want to pause for a second and talk about the term gentry. It's related to the term gentleman, and it means people who are considered to be gentlemen and ladies. And it's a rank that embraces essentially all of the rich and powerful families in the kingdom who were not members of the nobility. That is, they don't bear hereditary titles like barons or earls. To be a gentleman in this period, you have to bear arms. That is, you have to have a coat of arms, as we talked about in an earlier lecture. Now, at first, this was restricted to knights. But increasingly, you have members of knightly families who don't get formally knighted themselves. It's too expensive, for one thing. And yet, these people still come from these good families with excellent pedigrees. So now, if you're a member of the gentry, if you come from one of these arms-bearing families, whether or not you are technically a knight. So if you are a yeoman who wants to become a member of the gentry, you need to get a coat of arms. And so, in the 15th century, you make one up. You could just hire a herald to invent one. Essentially, becoming a gentleman in the 15th century is really a question of whether you can pull it off. That is, whether you cut a plausible figure as a gentleman. This obviously led to some rather nice calculations. You have to judge whether it's a good time to unveil that new coat of arms. Will it be accepted? Will it be laughed at? We certainly know that a number of families pulled this off. They made this climb successfully. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about one such family, the Pastons of Norfolk. Now, this family is very famous because they wrote a lot of letters to each other that spanned the 15th century. So we have a wonderful insight into their personal relationships, the hardships they encountered, all sorts of aspects of gentry life. So let's first figure out how they became members of the gentry. The founder of the family was William Paston, who lived from 1378 to 1444. His origins are rather obscure. He was the son of a Clement Paston of the village of Paston on the coast of Norfolk. Possibly Clement Paston was one of those yeoman farmers who acquired enough resources to send his son off to train for the law because William Paston became a lawyer, and he made his legal career largely in Norfolk. He acted as counsel for the city of Norwich, and he did work for the Bishop of Norwich. He also acted as a royal judge. And in 1415, he became the steward of the Duke of Norfolk. This was a very high office within the Duke's household. And here he's fulfilling functions that might have had to be carried out by clerics in the past, but now you have this new class of educated, legally trained laymen who are making their living as administrators. Now, along the way, William Paston acquired substantial estates, and that was clearly the goal of anybody on the make in the 15th century, because it's still vital to have land. That's still the ultimate source of wealth and power. And William also acquired a wife who belonged unquestionably to the gentry, a woman named Agnes Berry, who was the daughter of a knight from Hertfordshire. So now William Paston has arrived. He has land, and he has a socially prominent wife. He is a gentleman. Now, of course, his children and grandchildren are going to want to maintain this hard-won status, but they face several obstacles that every member of their class faces in the 15th century. For one thing, exactly the same conditions that are making it possible for yeomen to climb up into the gentry could make it hard for the gentry to stay where they were. So let's set the past and aside for a moment and talk about the economic problems of the gentry as a whole. You have low rents, you have high wages. That hurts holders of large estates more than it does people who are trying to build up an estate from scratch. Now, one response that many large landowners had was to abandon the whole search for good tenants. In fact, they abandoned arable farming altogether in favor of pastoral farming, mainly the raising of sheep. We've talked before about the importance of wool in the English economy. This got even more pronounced in the 15th century. And one result is that many landlords wind up enclosing lands that were formerly used to grow crops. They would put big hedges around them. And this was a rather large change in the organization of the countryside. You'll remember in our earlier discussions of how farming was organized, you had largely open fields. You had long strips that allowed people to plow with those oxen who didn't like to turn around very often. And you also have common lands that are open to anybody for pasturing their animals, for gathering wild plants for food, that sort of thing. But now you have a move towards enclosing lands for sheep to graze on, and that means more and more lands are privatized. You see a decline in the amount of common land that's available to common use. You can't wander freely across the land anymore because you have all those hedges. Now, certainly this hurt some of the small farmers. Some were probably bullied into surrendering their holdings so they could be enclosed. And the loss of the common lands was a substantial loss. Still, the scale of forcible enclosures has probably been exaggerated. It used to be thought that you had many, many villages abandoned wholesale due to enclosure. Now, if you actually look at aerial photography, you can see across the English landscape hundreds of lost villages. And it's easy to conjure up a terrible image of whole communities destroyed by rapacious landlords. But archaeologists have studied these sites more carefully, and it looks as if they're abandoned not at any one particular time all at once in response to this enclosure movement, but in dribs and drabs over the whole of the Middle Ages. We're looking at the normal growth cycle of medieval towns. So it's not all greedy landlords. In fact, at the same time as landlords are enclosing their fields, some tenants are enclosing their own lands. They saw the wisdom of the new methods. If we look at the financial records of some landlords in the 15th century, we can see it's very clear that enclosure worked. It increased the yields from their estates. Wool paid. But the wool trade had changed a lot since we last looked at it in the 13th century. The Hundred Years' War had disrupted trade with the continent significantly. Merchants who specialized in exporting raw wool from England to the Low Countries had suffered. There's a tax on wool, for one thing. So English tradesmen made an important adjustment. They increased their production of finished cloth, both for export and for the internal market. And between the mid-14th century and the mid-15th century, the export of English broadcloth increased by more than tenfold. Now, broadcloth gets its name from the fact that it's made on a broad loom. And production tended to be concentrated in certain areas of the country, especially East Anglia and the West Country. Both of these had access to good sheep-raising areas. And cloth was produced by a process known as farming out. A merchant would buy raw wool from individual sheep farmers, and then it would be parceled out to individual craftspeople who were engaged in the various steps of cloth production. You'd start with the carders. They would card the wool. They'd comb it and remove all of the tangles and burrs and other impurities. Then it would go to the spinners and then the weavers, and all of these would work in their own homes under the aegis of a factor. And the factor would be in charge of coordinating the whole process. Essentially, the factor would go around to the different carders and spinners and weavers and check up on them, making sure that the whole pipeline was flowing as it should. And this kind of small-scale craft work is referred to as cottage industry, because it literally took place in the cottages of the workers themselves. And this kind of work provided employment for many underemployed people, especially women and children. Now, once the broadcloth was done, it would be marketed either at home or abroad. And the export trade was handled by the Company of Merchant Adventurers. This was a group of merchants that traded with the continent, particularly with the city of Antwerp in the Low Countries. They were granted a royal charter by King Henry IV in 1407, but they date back probably to the early 14th century. This was a guild of merchants. That means you had to belong to it if you wanted to trade in broadcloth. It was a monopoly. And one thing that's very characteristic of medieval trade is that it's very far from being free trade. There's a lot of politics involved. Merchants lobbied the king for special privileges, and they're often willing to pay to get them. And the cloth lobby was very powerful in the Middle Ages. I want to get back now to our gentry family, the Pastons. They're trying to survive, as I said, in this atmosphere of economic change, and it's a very tough climate for gentry families because the competition among them could be very vicious. The gentry are all trying desperately to maintain their status. For some of them, like the Pastons, it's newly acquired. Others have been part of the elite for centuries. There's only so much land, only so much social capital to go around. And given the political disorder at the top in England, disputes in the localities would often spiral out of control and become violent. And these disputes often centered around claims to property acquired either by marriage or by inheritance. The first resort for such disputes was naturally the royal courts. And as this period saw a large increase in the number of lawyers, it also saw a large increase in the number of lawsuits. And many of the letters of the Paston family were written because some member of the family or other was stuck in London dealing with one of these lawsuits over the family property, and the wives would be back at home writing to tell them what was going on the home front. Oftentimes, the news from home would be ominous, because at the same time as the man of the house is off defending the estate in court, the estate itself might come under physical attack from the Pastons' enemies. Now, the most serious challenge to the Pastons was a charge raised in court that their ancestors had been serfs, and this would have invalidated the claim of William Paston's son, John, to inherit his estate. And I think it's a very telling reminder of how newly arrived the Pastons are. This is a claim that somebody felt might potentially stick. But the king and the council ruled against this claim in 1461, and that at least put the paternal inheritance on a sound footing. But things were especially bad for the Pastons in 1465. John Paston was actually imprisoned in London as part of the legal maneuvering in a lawsuit between him and the Duke of Suffolk. And it related to the Paston estate at Drayton. Paston had inherited this from a grateful client, Sir John Fastolf, and incidentally, this Sir John Fastolf is probably the man on whom Shakespeare partly based his character of Falstaff, though Shakespeare puts him about 50 years earlier in the reign of Henry IV. So here you have John Paston in prison, and his wife Margaret is writing to him rather frantically to say that the Duke of Suffolk's retainers have been boasting that now they're going to get hold of Drayton, because John Paston is in prison. And the implication is that if Paston were at home in person, these retainers wouldn't have such a good chance of extracting the estate from him. So Margaret Paston writes, "For the reverence of God, if you can manage it by any reasonable or honorable means, get out of there as soon as you can and come home amongst your friends and tenants. And that would be the greatest comfort they could have, and the contrary for your enemies." Now, the atmosphere in Norfolk is made even more difficult by the fact that all of England is divided in this period between two main political factions that are battling it out for the throne at this point, the Lancastrians and the Yorkists. And this is the period of the so-called Wars of the Roses, which we'll be getting to in future lectures. The bitterness of political division at the top is added onto local rivalries over property and prestige. And the result is that gentry families, like the Pastons, feel embattled, even besieged. There's a current of anxiety running through the Paston letters. This is really quite striking. And you have to feel for this family. They've worked so hard to get where they are. and now they constantly have to defend their position on every side. But I want to shift now to talk about some positive developments in this period, in the sphere of culture. And they certainly suggest that however anxious of an age this might be for some people, it's also a fairly prosperous age. I'm going to talk first about building and then about literature. Now, when people in the Middle Ages decided to undertake a large building project, it was a vote of confidence in the economy. Such projects could take many years to complete, and they were enormously expensive by contemporary measures. We've already seen that bishops sometimes got their churches into trouble by building too ambitiously. But the 15th century was a great age of building. One striking development is that many towns are building large guild halls or corn markets to facilitate trade. Corn here means grain in general. So a corn market is a place where people are going to gather to arrange the sale of grain. And these buildings are large and impressive. Many of them still stand. For example, the Corn Exchange in Cambridge. It's now been turned into a major municipal venue. It hosts rock concerts and festivals and sporting events of all kinds. These municipal buildings, they reflect the growing importance of trade in the 15th century. Now, of course, this is still an agricultural economy, but there has been a steady trend in favor of commercialization and urbanization. And many new churches are built in this period, especially parish churches rather than monastic churches. This is an era when monasticism is, on the whole, on the decline. In London, for example, there's a fairly systematic remodeling of parish churches to conform to contemporary style. And the style here is the flamboyant Gothic that I talked about a few lectures back. So here are churches that are being spruced up to demonstrate the prosperity of their patrons. But in addition, there's a huge increase in the number of small churches, chapels and chantries that are being built in the towns. These are mini churches. They're basically there to provide a place for masses to be said, to pray for the souls of the departed. Maybe they're languishing in purgatory. It became fashionable in this period to endow a chapel or chantry so that these masses could be said perpetually. And the word chantry comes from chanting the mass. This was a lot cheaper than founding a whole new monastery with maybe 40 monks to support. For a chantry, you just need one priest. And if you're too poor to endow a whole chantry, you could actually pay for just a set number of masses. And this all did take a significant portion of the clerical underclass off of the unemployment rolls. They'd get jobs as chantry priests. So the chantry industry employed a lot of priests, but it also employed a lot of builders and architects. But building is not confined to the towns. You also see a huge increase in the number of stone churches being built from scratch in the countryside, particularly in East Anglia and in the Cotswolds. These are both areas that were being newly enriched by the wool trade. And in fact, historians refer to these churches as the wool churches because it was wool money that paid for them. And many of these churches also still stand today. And I just want to mention one other kind of building that was increasing in this period. I think it too tells us something about prosperity and trade and even the widening of horizons. You see an increase in the number of inns. Now, if a town wanted to attract traders, it needed good, comfortable, safe places for them to stay. Now, we've already encountered the Tabard Inn in Southwark, of course, when we talked about the pilgrims heading off to Canterbury. But even very small towns, places like Colchel in Warwickshire, had four inns. The inn built at Andover in Hampshire in 1444 to 45 cost £300. That's a lot of money at that time, especially for a relatively small market town like Andover. But clearly, it was felt to be a good investment. So obviously, people in the 15th century are not spending all of their time worrying about politics. They're thinking about the economy. They're displaying their wealth in a visible form to their neighbors in impressive churches and chapels. But they're also engaging in more private amusements. And one of these was reading and listening to stories about King Arthur. This had been going on for a long time, of course. But there had been some big changes. There were changes in the audience for the tales, also in the form in which the tales were being presented. and in the technology of presenting the tales to the reading public. Let me say first a few words about audience. Up until this point, the audience for literary works has been largely confined to the elite because literacy rates are rather low. The rate of literacy began to rise, though, largely because it became clear that the ability to read and write was a ticket to social mobility. This had always been the case for those wanting to advance at the church. But as we saw earlier, the law had expanded enormously as the venue for economic and social advancement, and literacy is obviously required for the law. Many forms of trade also required the ability to read and to do computations. Foreign trade could require very complex calculations of exchange rates, for example. So how did people learn to read? Within gentry families, literacy seems to have been passed on by the women of the family, or by hired tutors, usually clerics. Now, starting in 1440, rich young men would have the option of attending Eton, the first of the great English public schools, and public here really means private. But for the lower orders, there were also an increasing number of options as the Middle Ages progressed. Many parish priests had informal schools to earn extra income, and this was a tradition that continued down to relatively modern times. There was also an increasing number of grammar schools in this period. These were more formal schools under the guidance of a master, and often the whole school would occupy just a single room. The master would teach the older boys, and then the older boys would teach the younger boys. And by 1500, many of the larger towns in England had grammar schools. And of course, starting in the middle of the 15th century, there's a whole new way to employ these literate skills, the technology of movable type, first perfected by the Gutenbergs in Germany around 1450. That's introduced to England by William Caxton. Caxton was originally a merchant, and he got involved in overseas trade in the Low Countries and Germany, and that's how he encountered the new technology of printing. And he wasted no time setting up a press of his own. First, he set one up in Bruges in Flanders. But by 1476, he had a press in Westminster. And the first work he produced there was an edition of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Now, Caxton was a big proponent of the English language. And though he did print works in other languages, 4/5 of the works he printed were in English. And one effect of printing was that it started to cause a certain degree of standardization in the written form of the language. Caxton wanted to establish certain standard forms and keep to them. Now, in the 14th century, you could tell from the dialect in a text what part of the country it was probably written in. We saw that when we talked about Piers Plowman. But that became less and less true as you kind of see standard written English taking over. This takes a while, but the development gets started right away with Caxton. Now, one other change due to the arrival of printing is that obviously the availability of print editions makes a big impact on how widely texts can circulate. They could simply reach far more people, and the reading public expands enormously. All of those lawyers and merchants who've learned how to read because it's useful for their work, now they can take advantage of the opportunity to relax and read for pleasure. And among the texts that they're reading is a very important work that Caxton printed in 1485. It's called Le Mort d'Arthur. But don't let the French title fool you, because this was the first ever version of the King Arthur story in English prose. We've already seen that the 14th century brought the big advance that now you have Arthurian stories written in English verse, and very sophisticated verse at that. Now, in the 15th century, you have this huge compendium, the most extensive to date of all of the Arthur stories, in a fairly straightforward style, accessible to pretty much any educated person. Now, the author of this work was named Sir Thomas Malory, and his life seems to have been just about as colorful as that of the characters he wrote about. He was a knight from Warwickshire, probably born around 1405, and he was twice elected to Parliament. But during the 1450s, he was in trouble with the law on numerous occasions. At various points, he was accused of burglary, rape, sheep stealing, and even of attempting to ambush Humphrey Stafford, Duke of Buckingham. On two occasions, he escaped from jail. Once, by seizing a number of weapons, fighting his way out, and swimming across a moat. So when Mallory wrote about adventures, he knew what he was talking about. And in fact, he actually wrote a lot of the text while he was in jail. Now, Mallory's Arthur is geared to the new literate classes, the gentry to whom he himself belonged, and also the wider reading public of lawyers and tradesmen. And it's a very English Arthur. And I just want to say a little bit here about the preface to the edition that Caxton printed. It shows the great pride that the English are taking in Arthur. Caxton starts by saying that Arthur is famous all around Europe, and that books are written about him in many languages. But it's a pity that until now, his whole story hasn't been available in English. Apparently, Caxton says, citing the Bible, "No man is a prophet in his own country." But, Caxton says, "Mallory's work is going to change all that." Now think for a moment what has happened to the story of King Arthur since we first encountered it. Arthur starts out possibly as a British war leader, trying to stem the tide of Germanic settlement in Britain. He's the enemy of the people who later become known as the English. Later on, he becomes the literary toast of Europe, primarily via stories written in French. Finally, Arthur is reappropriated by the English and turned into their hero, a source of national pride. So there's irony here, certainly. But it's pretty impressive how the English have managed to absorb these stories and make them their own. Now, I want to end this lecture by quoting a few lines from Caxton's preface, because I think they capture something about life in the 15th century. You've got some people newly prosperous, you have a lot of people anxious to keep what they've earned, and you have a new group of readers who need a break from those anxieties. The kind of break that they'd get by sitting down with a good book. So this is what Caxton says. "And for to pass the time, this book shall be pleasant to read in. But for to give faith and believe that all is true that is contained herein, ye be at your liberty." In other words, I'm guaranteeing this is a good read. But as for it being true, you're on your own with that. Now, in our next lecture, we're going to go back to the chronological narrative, and we'll find out what happened after Henry Bolingbroke took over the throne from Richard II, and we'll follow Bolingbroke's son, Henry V, to victory at Agincourt.
Lecture 32, Henry V and the Victory at Agincourt.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at life in England in the 15th century, and we saw that for the broad mass of English men and women, it was pretty good, despite the fact that at the top, there's lots of political disorder and instability. Now, over the next few lectures, we're going to look at what that instability and disorder consisted of. This is a period when the authority of the crown came under serious question. It changed hands a number of times between rival branches of the English royal family. It was a very dangerous time to be part of the ruling elite. Politics had gotten very bloody. We saw that already when we looked at Richard II's reign. But there was one brief bright spot amidst all of the faction fighting and political murder. England did make a spectacular comeback in the war against France. Now, all the gains were lost afterwards. But for a little while at least, it looked as if all of the glory of the good old days of Edward III might be coming back. So today, we're going to look at this brief shining moment, the reign of Henry V and his splendid victory at Agincourt. But first, we have to talk about his father, Henry IV. You'll remember back one lecture we talked about the deposition and death of Richard II. And the man who replaced him on the throne was Henry Bolingbroke, Duke of Lancaster. Now, because he was Duke of Lancaster, we call his family the Lancastrian dynasty. Now, Henry's accession to the throne caused a number of problems. It was unprecedented in recent centuries for somebody who wasn't the nearest heir by blood simply to seize the throne. As I mentioned earlier, since Richard II had no children, the nearest heir would have been Edmund Mortimer, Earl of March, because he was descended from the third son of Edward III, Lionel Duke of Clarence, whereas Henry Bolingbroke was descended from the fourth son, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster. So the Earl of March has priority over Henry Bolingbroke. To make matters slightly more complicated, though, Mortimer is descended from Edward III through the female line. The succession had come through the daughter of Lionel, Duke of Clarence. Now, that shouldn't matter, should it? Because the whole English claim to the French throne that they've been fighting for since the 1330s is based on descent through the female line. So it's hardly fair to claim now that female succession is a bar. But in 1399, Mortimer is 8 years old. And the magnates of England don't want a child king. Now, interestingly, this is totally different from what had happened only a few decades before in 1377. That's when Richard II took the throne at the age of 10. But at that point, England seemed pretty stable, and the royal family was united. All of Richard's uncles are happy to help him rule. But now, in 1399, the situation is a lot more chaotic, and the consensus is that England needs a strong ruler. So Mortimer is passed over and Bolingbroke takes the throne. It's a realistic outcome politically, certainly, but it stores up trouble for later. The fact that you have this legitimate heir who has been passed over, that's going to haunt English politics. Now, England, Edward III had five sons who lived to adulthood and fathered children. Then their offspring started intermarrying. And that ends up creating a whole bewildering array of claims to the throne. And we're going to get to all of that in future lectures. But for right now, let's figure out what's going on with the new king who is crowned as Henry IV. Now, Henry IV has a problem. He has set a very uncomfortable precedent by seizing the throne. His magnates have seen this done. And throughout his brief reign, he only ruled 14 years, he faces a series of rebellions designed to reverse the coup and put some more acceptable monarch on the throne. And this is the case largely because the main issues of Richard II's reign weren't really solved by getting rid of Richard. It's still hard to strike a balance between the king and the barons. The king sees himself as God's anointed with more or less unrestrained authority in England. On the other hand, you have the barons. They're now richer and more powerful than ever, and they're certainly feeling their oats now more than ever because they've deposed one king and created another. Now, I'm just going to talk about one of these rebellions that happens in Henry's reign. It's the one that Shakespeare writes about in his plays Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and it proved the most serious threat to the regime by far. It broke out in 1403, but some of the principals involved had been disaffected for some time before that. And the thing that made the rebellion so dangerous is that it ended up being led by an alliance of powerful men, all of whom had some sort of axe to grind against Henry IV. The first rebel to emerge was a formidable Welsh prince named Owen Glendower. He started causing trouble in Wales right at the start of Henry's reign. Now, Glendower is a very interesting figure. He's descended from Welsh princes on both sides of his family, but earlier in his career, he had actually served in the English royal forces. But then in 1400, he had gotten into a dispute with a marcher lord who backed Henry IV. Glendower and most of Wales had really been pro-Richard. And this dispute with this marcher lord drove Glendower into rebellion, and he succeeded in rousing much of Wales to his cause. And he did some very interesting things. He called a Welsh parliament, he appointed a chancellor, and he drew up plans, rather grandiose plans, really, for two new Welsh universities. He also struck an alliance with France, and he had feelers out, diplomatic feelers to other states in Europe. Really, what he wanted to do was turn Wales into a proper kingdom on a par with England, and people were starting to mention him in the same breath as King Arthur. Now, Glendower ended up allying with another rebel named Henry Percy, known as Hotspur, the son of the Earl of Northumberland. Now, Hotspur had a grievance against Henry IV. Hotspur had won a great battle against the Scots, and he'd captured a man named the Earl of Dunbar. And the Earl of Dunbar was a very valuable prisoner, and Hotspur wanted to collect a ransom for him. But the king demanded that Hotspur hand over custody of Dunbar to him personally, so he wasn't going to get a ransom out of this. And so there's certainly a very personal grievance between Hotspur and the king. But Hotspur claimed to be rebelling in favor of the Earl of March, the rightful heir. Now, this is pretty rich. Hotspur had been up to his neck in the deposition of Richard, but now he claims, after the fact, that really all he had in mind by helping Bolingbroke was to get him his rightful inheritance as Duke of Lancaster. He hadn't seen the deposition of the king coming at all. That wasn't what he had had in mind. Now, this is totally disingenuous, of course. But Hotspur also threw into the mix a list of criticisms of how Henry had been ruling as king. Henry had not been able, for example, to keep a pledge not to raise taxes. So in 1403, Hotspur goes up against the royal army, and in the battle at Shrewsbury, he is defeated and killed. But after the Battle of Shrewsbury, that's not the end of the rebellion. Hotspur's father, the Earl of Northumberland, takes up his cause, and he makes a triple alliance with Glendower on the one hand, and a third rebel, Sir Edmund Mortimer. Now, Mortimer is, in a personal sense, probably the least impressive of these rebels. But he's very potentially dangerous to the king because of who he is. Sir Edmund Mortimer is the uncle of the young Earl of March, who, as we've said, is technically the one with the best claim to the English throne. Now, Sir Edmund Mortimer had been captured in the fighting against the Welsh rebels at the outbreak of the revolt. But at that point, King Henry refused to ransom him. He said, let him stay in captivity in Wales. From Henry's point of view, he's quite happy to have him out of the way where his claim to the throne isn't going to cause any problems for Henry himself. And this obviously made Mortimer pretty angry. You know, you're letting me rot in captivity here. So Mortimer switched sides. He joined up with Glendower and married Glendower's daughter. So now we have three rebels, Northumberland, Glendower, and Mortimer. And in 1405, they take up arms, and they claim to be trying to put the rightful heir on the throne. And the plan the rebels drew up was that they were going to make a tripartite division of England, known as the tripartite indenture. Glendower was going to get Wales, of course, but he was going to also get some of the border counties of England. And Northumberland, who's from the north, is going to get the northern counties. Mortimer is going to be left with the rest, a kind of a rump of England. So they were going to dismember the country. And there were some very powerful men involved in this conspiracy, including the Archbishop of York. But in the end, only Glendower poses a serious military threat. The northern rebels are defeated. The Archbishop of York is tricked into surrendering and then beheaded. Glendower keeps fighting, though, till 1409. But after that, he simply melts away. He's never captured. Nobody knows what became of him. Now, the upshot of all of this is that Henry IV's reign is marked by chronic instability. The king is never able to relax. Rumors go around that King Richard is still alive. Plots are uncovered and foiled on a regular basis. And this is why Shakespeare has Henry deliver the well-known line, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." And that really definitely fits this period. For the last few years of his reign, Henry IV is chronically ill, and the public is basically just waiting for him to die so that he can be succeeded by his popular son, Prince Hal. Now, our picture of Henry V, as Prince Hal becomes, is so colored by Shakespeare's play that it can be hard to separate the fictional prince from the historical prince. Shakespeare gives us a prince who spends all his time with low companions. He hangs out in taverns, and he totally neglects the responsibilities of a prince. But in the play, Prince Hal lets us know that he's got a plan. He's planning to undergo a reformation when he finally becomes king, and that's going to make him seem even more impressive. Now, the reality of Prince Henry's career in the last years of his father is really somewhat different. Henry actually had an impressive military record in the Welsh Revolt, and he's not divorced from affairs at court, far from it. He's engaged in a serious faction fight against his own brother, Prince Thomas, the second son of Henry IV. Each of them has their band of noble supporters, and at one point, Prince Henry even declares that he's afraid for his own safety. And the king, throughout, is semi-incapacitated due to illness. So the situation is very tense, threatening to spiral out of control. So when Henry finally does succeed his father in 1413, he's got this legacy of instability to deal with. But he's briefly able to restore order to English politics, partly by giving the English a magnificent distraction, military victory overseas. Because Henry's overriding ambition is to restore the glory of the victories won in France by his great-grandfather, Edward III. He wants glory for its own sake, certainly, but he's also determined to siphon off some of the troublemakers who are threatening to make his reign very difficult. But before we can follow him to France, we need to talk about some of the very serious threats that he had to face at home in England. One of the troublemakers was a man named Sir John Oldcastle. Oldcastle had been close to Prince Henry during the Welsh campaigns, and Henry had even used his influence to help Oldcastle marry a rich heiress, and her title allowed Oldcastle to take a seat in the House of Lords. So he's a socially prominent individual, but he is also a Lollard. Now, we talked about the Lollard heresy back when we discussed the Peasants' Revolt. Lollardy had gone underground, but it still had supporters, and Oldcastle was one of them. And since he was wealthy and very well connected, he used his castle in Kent as a place of refuge for fellow Lollards. Then the Archbishop of Canterbury got wind of this, and he wanted to act against Oldcastle. But he had to be careful because Oldcastle is the king's friend. But on the other hand, that makes it even more important to act against Oldcastle because you don't want the king's friend being found to be such a notorious heretic. That doesn't set a good example. Now, Oldcastle could probably have gotten off if he had just used his royal influence, but that would have meant renouncing his beliefs, because King Henry was not going to countenance heresy openly. He personally was very orthodox in his own religious opinions. So Oldcastle defied the ecclesiastical court, and he was handed over to the secular court for punishment. Now, you'll remember that since 1401, it's been the law in England that heretics can be burned. In reality, this had only happened a couple of times. People really didn't like to do it. But the king requested a stay of execution to give him time to try to talk Oldcastle out of his stubborn position. But then Oldcastle escaped from the Tower of London. He'd been imprisoned there, and, you know, the Tower of London looks very formidable, but as we've already seen, you can get out of it. In early 1414, the Lollards, under Oldcastle's leadership, attempt a revolt in London. You have contingents of Lollards converging on the capital from all over the country, from as far away as Warwick and Derby. But the authorities had gotten wind of this, the rising is swiftly put down, and the most important leaders are executed, except for Oldcastle. Oldcastle escaped, and he spent 3 years on the run before he was finally captured and put to death. Now, one reason I've spent some time talking about Oldcastle is that he is one of the models for Shakespeare's character Falstaff. I've talked about one of the models before, a knight named Sir John Fastolf. He lived later in the 15th century and got involved in legal transactions with the Paston family in Norfolk. But Oldcastle gives Shakespeare one of the central elements of Falstaff's character. You've got the companion of Prince Henry's youth who has to be cast aside for political reasons when he becomes king. It's just that those political reasons were totally different in reality than they are in the play. In the play, Falstaff is a riotous man, a glutton, a thief. And when the prince turns his back on Falstaff, he's turning his back on his dissolute youth. In reality, Sir John Oldcastle is a very serious man. He's a convinced Lollard. Henry has to turn his back on him because it would be politically dangerous to seem to approve of heresy. But the Oldcastle plot is not nearly as serious from a military perspective as the other major plot that Henry faces early in his reign, This second plot is very much a continuation of the same power struggles that have been going on in his father's reign, and the whole dynamic goes back to the instability caused by the deposition of Richard. There were just a lot of people out there now who don't see why they shouldn't go ahead and topple the king if that's going to work out well for them. Clearly, there were nobles who figured that the best way to get wealth and influence is for the king to owe you everything, even his throne. There are people out there who want to be kingmakers. Now, the plot is known as the Cambridge Plot, because one of the ringleaders was Richard, Earl of Cambridge, the younger brother of the Duke of York. He's actually the king's cousin. The two other main confederates were Lord Scroope of Massam and Sir Thomas Grey of Heaton. And their plan is to assassinate the king while he's getting ready to embark for France. And they're going to replace him on the throne with the Earl of March. You can see that it's very destabilizing having somebody like the Earl of March around. Later on, English kings are going to draw the obvious conclusion and just systematically get rid of people like that, but we're not quite there yet. So apparently, some of the rebels had been urging the Earl of March for several years to try to claim his rightful throne, but he didn't want any part of it, and he makes a very prudent move. He gives away the plot to the king. The three ringleaders are executed, and Henry never again faces a serious threat to his throne, largely because of what he's about to accomplish. He sets sail for France and victory. Now, before we follow him to the battlefield, though, we need to pause for a second and figure out what's been going on between England and France in the last 20 years or so. We saw that under Richard II, a truce was agreed between the two countries, but that had pretty much collapsed when Richard was deposed. The new Lancastrian government sent Richard's young French queen, Isabella, back to France. And France reconfirmed the truce, but they had cleverly managed to avoid officially acknowledging Henry IV's right to the English throne. And the French turned down Henry's offer to have one of his sons marry Isabella. And things deteriorated from there. As we've seen, the French allied with Owen Glendower. They raided the Channel coast. They raided the Channel Islands. And this would have been a great opportunity for the French to just get rid of the English in France once and for all. But the problem was that the French were divided among themselves. The French royal house was divided into two hostile factions, and that fact was probably really the only thing that saved the English garrison at Calais in this period. This is the serious situation that Henry V is trying to remedy. He wants to restore English glory in France. He wants to be seen as a chivalric hero. This is going to be what the English expect their king to be. It's going to be a way of legitimizing his rather questionable right to the throne. So off Henry goes to France in August of 1415. It's probably a good time to attack France because the French government is in crisis. The king, Charles VI, is undergoing one of his periodic bouts of insanity. There seems to have been a genetic disorder in the family. And the two main royal factions, Burgundy and Orléans, are quarreling over the right to rule in the king's stead while he's insane. And the English are clearly hoping to take advantage of their opponent's difficulties. So Henry lands with a relatively small force, maybe around 10,000 men. He settles down to besiege the Channel port of Harfleur, which is near the mouth of the Seine. And it surrenders after about a month. And then Henry does basically the same thing that Edward III had done with Calais. He gets rid of the French inhabitants of the city, and he's planning to replace them with English colonists. But the siege had taken longer than Henry had hoped. The army was depleted by the need to garrison Harfleur while they're waiting for reinforcements to arrive. And there was an outbreak of dysentery among the English soldiers. So Henry decided to change his plans. He had probably intended to march on Paris or on Bordeaux. He could have just hunkered down at Harfleur. But instead, he wanted to show himself in France a bit, see some of the country that he's now claiming to be king of. He wants to get his army from Harfleur to Calais to take up winter quarters. Now, this would have been a march of about 170 miles if they'd been able to go in a straight line. But the French had not been idle. A large French army had gathered at Rouen. and they moved to block the English advance. And again, the English had to change direction to avoid the French, and this made their march much longer. Finally, the French army got in between the English and Calais, near the town of Agincourt. And the French outnumbered the English probably several times over, although the statistics in these cases are notoriously unreliable. So there are a lot more French than English. Still, the smart thing for the French would probably have been just to keep shadowing the English as they marched around the countryside, getting weaker and weaker. As I've said before, battles in medieval warfare are comparatively rare. The smart decision is often not to fight them. Don't fight a battle. Just let your enemy defeat himself. But the French were eager to fight. Officially, they were led by a couple of very experienced commanders. You have the Constable of France, Charles d'Albret, and the Marshal of France, Boucicault. Now, the Marshal and the Constable wanted to postpone the battle, but they were overruled by some very eager young noblemen in the army who want glory. And this turns out to be a very, very bad decision. The battle was similar in some ways to the earlier battles of the Hundred Years' War that we've talked about before, Crécy and Poitiers. Once again, you have a smaller English force facing a numerically superior French force. But once again, the English fought the smarter battle. They deployed their forces very effectively to take good advantage of the terrain. The English were protected by a small wood, and the ground in front of them consisted of a recently plowed field. It turned very, very quickly into mud. And the mud caused the French a lot more trouble than the English, because the French were more heavily armed. And often, literally, they couldn't get up again once they fell in the mud. And the English also arranged their forces in the best possible way to maximize their strength and even up the discrepancy in numbers between them and the French. They arranged their men-at-arms in rows, four deep, with archers to protect them on the flanks, and they might have even had a central block of archers as well, splitting the men-at-arms into two groups. In addition, the English fixed long pointed stakes in the ground to force the French cavalry to veer off. A horse does not want to charge at a long pointed stake. The French, by contrast, don't seem to have figured out a good way to deploy their archers. Their archers are in the rear with the men-at-arms in the front, and nobody wants to let the archers fire for fear that they're going to hit their own men. So the French archers almost play no role in the battle at all. Essentially, the French men-at-arms and the cavalry are on their own. So, the French cavalry charged. But the charge was a disaster. The cavalry were hoping to outflank the English archers, but they were hemmed in by the woods on the sides, and then they ran up against those pointed stakes. Many horses were shot down. Their riders were floundering in the mud. Then, the French foot soldiers, the men-at-arms, advanced across the field, and it's getting muddier and muddier all the time. They actually did make it as far as the English line. But by the time they got there, they were essentially too exhausted to fight. They had to put their visors down to avoid being shot in the face by the English archers. That made it hard for them to breathe. They were wearing 50 to 60 pounds of armor. And by the time they met the enemy, some reports say they were unable to use their weapons. They were so tired. And it got ugly after that. The archers are out of arrows by now, and they just pick up whatever weapons they can find and join in the hand-to-hand fighting. And they have an advantage because they are less encumbered. They don't have this heavy armor on, and they're able to cut down many of the French men-at-arms. And this goes on for about 3 hours. It's probably a very, very long 3 hours for the people involved. Now, late in the battle, the French did manage to attack the rear of the English army, where the baggage train was stationed. And they even made off with one of King Henry's crowns. It's probably at this point in the battle that King Henry made the decision to kill the French prisoners who had already been taken in the battle, and there may have been several thousand of them. Possibly he feared a further attack by French reinforcements. Possibly he wants revenge for the attack on the baggage train. Now, Shakespeare invents a justification for killing all the prisoners. In the play, the French soldiers who attack the baggage train slaughter the boys who are guarding the baggage, the young boys. and the king is outraged, and he orders the prisoners killed out of anger at the murder of the defenseless boys. Now, clearly, Shakespeare does this because he's uncomfortable with the action of the king, so he gives Henry a good pretext for doing it. But it's interesting to note that at the time, not even the French protested. This is just war. The only people who were angry were the noblemen in the English army. They had hoped to hold the prisoners for ransom. And apparently the king actually had to get some of his archers to do the deed. His noble followers just couldn't bear to see all that money go to waste. But by this point, the battle is effectively over. The French counterattack never materialized. So what's the result of the Battle of Agincourt? It's a total disaster for the French. They probably lose 9 or 10 times as many soldiers as the English, including some very high-placed nobles. And the English were thrilled by their victory. Many texts were raised praising the king, including a famous song. The Agincourt song talks about the king's prowess in battle. It names the various nobles who also fought in their many deeds, and you have the sense in which this song embodies the national pride of the English, and it's a song written in English. The battle is simply the best news that the English have had in decades. For the next 5 years, though, there aren't a lot of battles, just a series of long sieges punctuated by diplomatic maneuvering. One innovation of this period is kind of interesting, though. For the first time in the West, you have cannons used effectively in attacking enemy fortresses. Slowly but surely, Henry extends his control over northern France, but his main success comes not from English arms, but from the results of this long-standing feud within the French royal family that I've already mentioned. The two French royal factions had been trying to make peace, but in 1419, the Duke of Burgundy was assassinated by partisans of the Dauphin, the heir to the French throne. And the next Duke of Burgundy, infuriated by the assassination, makes an alliance with the English. And the French are now caught between England and Burgundy, and they're forced to come to terms. So in 1420, the French and the English sign the Treaty of Troyes. And by the terms of the treaty, King Henry marries Princess Catherine, the daughter of the French king. And incidentally, Princess Catherine is the younger sister of the Princess Isabella, who had briefly been Richard II's queen. Isabella had died by this point. Now, the crucial thing about the marriage between Henry and Catherine is that the French succession is reserved for their heirs. The Dauphin, Catherine's brother, the supposed heir to the French throne, he's disinherited. The following year, Queen Catherine bore King Henry a son, also called Henry, and King Henry V becomes regent for his son, and his son is destined to inherit the thrones of both England and France. Now, the English Parliament had ratified the Treaty of Troyes, and this made the Parliament responsible for the king's French policy. They have a stake in its success, and that's going to mean that over the next few decades, the royal government is going to be judged based on how well it's able to enforce the terms of the Treaty of Troyes. Now, perhaps Henry V could have forged a united kingdom out of England and France. We'll never know, because he died of dysentery in 1422, leaving a 9-month-old son with the daunting task of living up to this father who had subdued one rebellious kingdom and conquered another. Alas, poor Henry VI would find the task too much for him, as we will find out in our next lecture.
Lecture 33, Henry VI, Defeat and Division.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at the reign of Henry V, and it seemed to end in triumph. Henry had won the Battle of Agincourt against all odds. He had taken advantage of a terrible split within the French royal family to force the French to sign a peace deal that gave his heirs the right to the French throne. But then Henry had died, leaving a 9-month-old son, Henry VI. And the new king just couldn't measure up to his father, and his reign was marked by defeat overseas and instability at home. The war in France dragged on, and it became a drain on English resources. Discontent over the state of the war led to opposition at home, within Parliament, and among